Young, it's here and now. British police say they've arrested 9 men on terrorism charges. Sky TV is reporting that the men planned to kidnap a Muslim British soldier and execute him Iraq style by beheading him and then posting this on the internet. Again, the police sources aren't saying much more. Jonathan Guthrie is covering the story for the Financial Times. Jonathan, these men we do know have yet to be charged, but what have police said about why they were arrested?
Well, they've been arrested on fairly general counter-terrorism charges, which mean they can be held for quite a while and questioned further. The police are keeping pretty quiet about what they might actually have been planning. There is obviously this story around about an Iraq-style execution plot, but it has to be stressed that that's unsubstantiated as yet. And the police and senior lawyers in the UK are warning media to be a little bit careful about how far they go with this for fear of prejudicing any future trial.
Well, as we mentioned, many British media organizations are quoting anonymous sources and reporting that the men were targeting a British Muslim soldier and that that soldier is under police protection.
That's the suggestion, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are police responding at all to those reports?
No, they're keeping very quiet about it. What they're saying, there was a very crowded press conference just over an hour ago at West Midlands Police Headquarters. What they were saying was that they were at the foothills of a very major investigation that could take days and weeks to resolve. There has been something of a feverish atmosphere, I think, in Birmingham today with quite a... They have been raided. They raided 8 properties. They've also cordoned off sections of streets. 4 business premises, including a Muslim bookshop and a cyber cafe, have been secured and searched.
Well, you mentioned Birmingham. Birmingham is also the hometown of Britain's first Muslim soldier to be killed in Afghanistan last year. And apparently, we're reading this was a death that prompted a lot of militant websites to denounce him as a traitor. And I'm wondering, how does that neighborhood in particular feel about British soldiers who are Muslim fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq, and how much might that underscore, if any of this alleged terrorist plot was true, how much might that underscore it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring this up because Lance Corporal Jabran Hashmi, who died in Afghanistan in July last year, there's recently been quite a lot of coverage about him because a memorial stone was unveiled to him locally where quite a lot of his family were there and said that he was a hero of Islam, Pakistan and Britain. So I think it's fair to say that there is probably no absolute consensus view in the Muslim community. There are, although they are always characterized as being entirely anti-Iraq war, I think there are people who've had a more positive attitude towards the military intervention. But I think it's fair to say that the great bulk of Birmingham Muslims have been opposed to war in Iraq. But frankly, so have quite a lot of non-Muslims as well.
Well, you mentioned that there's, you know, not a unified opinion. We're reading another Associated Press report in which the chairman of a Birmingham mosque says people don't trust their own children anymore responding to this alleged plot. Now, we've reported here on British children being preyed upon by terrorist groups hoping to enlist them. Is there that feeling as well? Are Muslim parents concerned about their children being involved in terrorist plots in these neighborhoods?
I think there is, and the experience in the British Muslim community has been one of considerable disappointment because initially when homegrown terrorism was discussed and suggested before there had ever been any attacks, it was always dismissed by community elders as being impossible. In fact, what we have seen is that 4 young men were prepared to blow themselves up and a lot of their fellow citizens on the transport system in London. What that told us was that Muslim elders were often not in contact at all with what was going on in the minds of their kids or what kinds of activities they were getting up to in the fridges of radical mosques. I think there's a high degree of intergenerational dislocation in the Muslim community, with quite often younger people being far more religiously fundamentalist in outlook than older people. But at the same time, one also has to recognize that kind of generation gap is reflected in much more conventional things like young Muslim men wanting to have white girlfriends to wanting to go to nightclubs. those kinds of things, which of course don't get reported because they don't have a political or a terrorist element to them.
Jonathan Guthrie of the Financial Times joining us from Birmingham on the latest terrorist arrest in London. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to spend some time today looking at the world of business through a prism presented in a recent Business Week report. It's the role of revenge in corporate America. Shakespeare says we will seek it if we are wrong. Charlotte Bronte described it as an aromatic wine, warm and racy. Others say it's sweet. And according to Business Week, it's very active in the nation's boardrooms. The cover story was compiled by managing editor Jenna McGregor. It's subtitled The Power of Retribution, Spite and Loathing in the World of Business. And to find out more about how bitterness affects the bottom line, Jenna joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
It doesn't really. I mean, we know that, you know, people can get angry, they can take it out on people, but, you know, really, does this bitterness affect the bottom line?
Well, I think if it gets out of hand, it's possible that it could. If a CEO is making decisions based on, you know, personal reasons that have nothing to do with the best interests of the company, then I think it's quite possible. But, you know, I think what we were looking to do is to say this is a human emotion that doesn't get talked about in the workplace, in our very corporate, cold environment that we often live in, and let's take a look at it.
In fact, Kenneth Siegel, an L.A. psychologist who coaches senior executives, told you that this is the great undiscussable.
He compared it to lust in the executive suite, I think, which is about how taboo of a subject it is among many of the people I spoke to. But when you speak to people like Siegel or like executive recruiters or like management consultants who really kind of have the hearts and minds of senior executives, they loved it. They were immediately, I see this all the time. This is really real, and, you know, you're barking up the right tree.
In fact, you met a headhunter who said that someone said to him, go hire someone from another company so that we can hurt the other company while we help mine.
He even would have people pay extra to do that. I mean, he described it as a bounty. And I think they really see the inner workings of these deals and understand how personal, especially people issues, can be.
Well, you also found some science behind this. I mean, this isn't just anecdotal. This isn't just a feeling that people have. You found science that says we all possess sort of a neurological inclination for revenge. Tell me about that.
Well, it was sort of, it's funny. It's kind of like the scientist proving something that we already kind of know, which is that whether it's Schadenfreude, you know, the fancy term for experience some kind of pleasure by someone else's harm or someone else's downfall, or true revenge, where you're actually actively hurting someone in some way for something that they've done to you, you know, the description sweet revenge, I think we can all identify with at least a little bit. And what this behavioral economist actually at the University of Zurich found is that when he sets people up in a certain scenario where they're exchanging money and hooks them up to a brain scan, someone who has been harmed, the pieces of their brain that feel satisfaction, it's actually called the caudate nucleus, is more strongly activated when the person was at least contemplating getting even. I think the real question is whether they still feel good after they do it.
That was fascinating. This is the work of Ernest Fehr, F-E-H-R, from the University of Zurich, who, as you said, hooked people's brains up. Well, so take us through some of the great business revenges in history, as you do in a sidebar story. It's called Corporate Revenge, A Brief History.
Yeah.
it starts with building and railroad tycoon Cornelius Vanderbilt in the 1850s. Two former business partners used a power of attorney to steal one of his companies when he was off on a cruise. He came back and had apparently a memorable business line. What was it?
Gentlemen, you have undertaken to cheat me. I won't sue you, for the law is too slow. I'll ruin you.
Did he?
He came pretty close. He converted his yacht to a passenger ship and said, I'm going to compete with you. He called his line the opposition line. And then eventually he was able to buy his way back in and regain control of the company. Now, this is before he moved on to railroads, but whether they were ruined or not, they were certainly taken out of power from his firm.
Did you meet anyone in modern day who told you, yeah, revenge was my motivator?
You know, one of the great things about Business Week is that we have a great team of reporters and a colleague of mine, Steve Hamm, did some great reporting with a gentleman named Terry Garnett, who is a former Oracle senior vice president, and this was back in the early 90s. So more than 12 years later, I think, he is starting up a firm where he is basically going directly after Oracle. Oracle and Ellison fired him. And I don't know that he actually used the word revenge, but he certainly said he holds grudges and that he's motivated by them.
He made a vow to himself, there will be a day of reckoning.
Yes.
Reckoning is maybe a more tempered word than revenge. And now he's CEO of AngCorp.
Yes, which is a software upstart that's actually using an open source model to try to kind of torpedo Oracle's database business. And, you know, they're a very small player at this point, but he has interestingly hired, I think there's 50 of the 250 people in his firm have some kind of Oracle pedigree, and some of the board members do too. And to the point where he even kind of defined what he was trying to do was to build a culture of former Oracle folks. He said, the simplest way to create a culture is to pick an enemy. And we have an enemy, and that's Oracle.
In 1984, Lee Iacocca was sacked by Ford Motor Company. He ended up turning around Chrysler and then wrote his own book, completely dissing Henry Ford throughout
yes.
the book. Revenge was sweet there. But, yes, we hasten to point out it doesn't always work. You tell the story of the Muses who were fired by Southwest Airlines, or deposed, let's say,
mm-hmm.
by Southwest Airlines and started their own airline, Muse Air. I've never heard of Muse Air.
Neither had I. I don't think it lived very long. The industry analysts all dubbed it Revenge Air when they started it out. And basically they tried to take a very different tack than Southwest Airlines did. They had this very upscale, smoke-free, sophisticated experience, but it never really went anywhere. And eventually, Southwest actually bought it out. So, did anybody really win in trying to get back? I don't know.
Hmm. You talk to psychologists, as we said, and mm-hmm. they explain, or as you write, that revenge is a response to a perceived injustice, or what psychologists call narcissistic injury, wounded ego. Why is it, you know, more acute, as you write, for people in business?
I think there's several types of people in business for which it's especially acute. One is the entrepreneur whose identity is completely wrapped up in the business that they're creating. You try to separate them from that, and you're not just firing them from their job. You're taking away a piece of what they've created and their identity. Same thing with people in family businesses that are very wrapped up in things. And same thing for people who are very, very highly placed in an organization, you know, the CEO or C-level executives. I think they have a tendency, because they have so much power in the organization, to really take on a lot more identity that has to do with the organization. And therefore, again, you're separating that, and that's really personal and can get really ugly.
Jenna McGregor, her article in Business Week magazine is entitled Revenge, the Power of Retribution, Spite, and Loathing in the World of Business. So what is Laurence Olivier's son doing in this story? We'll find out after the break, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Jenna McGregor, management editor at Business Week magazine. She wrote the article, Revenge, the Power of Retribution, Spite, and Loathing in the World of Business. Jenna, we've been talking about some of the classic cases that lead to revenge when someone is fired. They want retribution, and they might get it by forming a new company to try to unseat their old employer. But you write another way spurned executives get back at their old companies is by turning around an existing yet struggling competitor. You write, for instance, about Millard Mickey Drexler. He ran The Gap for 19 years, was pushed out in 2002, went over to J. Crew. He said his goal was to give The Gap a run for its money. He said that was a real motivator, and he seemed to achieve it. Tell us more about him.
I think Mickey is a great example of someone who fits the phrase, living well is the best revenge. I mean, this is a guy who left behind a major severance package, and I think he's experiencing at least some sweet revenge. He has recruited at least two dozen executives away from The Gap. There does seem to be some level of competition there, but I think what's key is that he left, you know, an organization that was not doing very well and went on to great success at J. Crew, which was one of the best IPOs of last year.
And public sales, yep.
Yes, one of the best initial public offerings, and has really shown some great numbers quarter after quarter.
Probably the ultimate revenge after being let go is to get your old job back, though. Not just to start another competitor, but that brings us to Steve Jobs at Apple, ousted in 85. He returns 12 years later and shines. But tell us about Malcolm Walker, a British entrepreneur. He was the founder of Iceland. It's a European grocery chain specializing in frozen foods. He was, I think, about to retire when he had to resign.
Yes, he was about to retire, but just before he retired, he made a pretty controversial stock sale of his own stock that was closely followed by a report of a profit warning. And so there was some question of insider trading. And so he kind of retired, quote, in a cloud. And when he left, he went on to start this new competitive firm and eventually, kind of trapped on the sidelines, managed to help buy back the former firm that he had grown for 30 years. And, he seems to be having a little bit of fun now that he's back. He has renamed the years he was away on the website the Dark Ages. And he, has sent a dossier of his own to a British regulatory agency, sort of questioning some of the finances while he was away. So, I think we think of Steve Jobs as this classic character who is able to come back to the firm that he started. But it does happen more often than we might think.
Well, who knew? Into all of this wanders Richard Olivier, the son of Laurence Olivier, who makes an appearance as someone who runs workshops using Shakespearean plays to help leaders, find these motivations, revenge, ambition, power. What does he tell you about revenge in business?
Isn't that fascinating?
It
Richard
is.
Olivier? I mean, you mentioned earlier the sort of connotations that I think we usually think of with revenge, and I think we think of many of those because of Shakespeare. And he actually works with leaders to help them identify. They use Shakespeare monologues, and they go through them and try to act them out and role play to sort of help them get in touch with and recognize not just feelings of revenge, although that is a key one, but ambition and power and how all those things can go awry.
And how they can get in their way without them even knowing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as he says, it's not so blatant that, look, the guy in the corner office has a knife in his back. It's something more passive than that.
I think that's key. We've been talking a lot about these very personality-driven stories and about CEOs who may take their share of payback or vengeance. But I think what really happens in the workplace on a day-to-day basis is much smaller and much more mundane than that, but it is very real, which is, a disgruntled employee leaking something to the press or somebody talking bad behind a colleague's back who they feel like has taken credit for their idea. The little things that make a workplace, either a good place to work or a bad place to work, but that really are little elements of revenge in the workplace.
People dying the death of a thousand small cuts, says
yes.
Olivier. very dramatically. Well, who hasn't, been let go from a place and you become your own Supreme Court case in your head or your own Broadway play where you're singing about how you are going to get back at people. But is it also a motivator for, just the worker in the cubicle?
I think it happens all the time. We've already gotten letters from people who have shared a little story of a moment when they contemplated getting revenge. Even just a colleague they didn't like who lost a file, and they debated, make her realize that I have it or do I not? I think it happens quite often.
Geez, if you watch The Office on television, you know that it does. But you actually found a Georgetown University management professor, Robert Bees. He's been studying this since 1996. What does he say? Do people, when they do things like this in the workplace, again, in the cubicle, this is, revenge in the cubicle, do they think that they're doing that?
No, they don't. He very interestingly, he will ask the question two ways. He will say, "Do you engage in revenge in the workplace?" And everyone says, "Oh, no, 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 no." And then he asks them, "Have you ever gotten even with someone in the workplace?" And they say, "Oh, yes, all the time. It happens all the time." It's very much in the way you word it. The interesting thing about his study has been, how do you prevent it from happening? Which is trying to take some of the surprise out of what you share with your employees.
tell us more about that. In other words, this is something management can do to sort of nip revenge in the bud. What can they do?
Well, his belief is, you know, the reason, one of the reasons, I mean, obviously, we don't like revenge, it's kind of a taboo topic, but on top of that, business is so primed for standardization and predictability, and his argument is managers have a responsibility for predictability in the workplace, for not creating surprises to people, and that can help to mitigate potential for revenge. Let people know that layoffs are coming. Explain why you're making budget cuts. You know, do the kind of things that make things not a surprise to people, and you can probably get rid of some of the retaliatory things that people might do.
Jenna McGregor is a management editor at Business Week magazine. For more on her article, by the way, Sweet Revenge, The Power of Retribution, Spite, and Loathing in the World of Business, go to our website, here-now.org. Jenna, thanks so much, and watch your back.
Thank you, Robin. You too.
We'll stay right there. Still to come today, we'll invite a media critic in to, well, criticize us if he wants, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Later in the program, the Tonys of the college theater set, but we start with the Libby trial. Former New York Times reporter Judith Miller takes the stand again today in the trial of vice presidential aide Louis Scooter Libby. Yesterday, Miller said her notes showed that Libby told her the name of the CIA agent wife of Iraq war critic Joseph Wilson in June of 2003. That contradicts Libby's claim that he didn't hear Valerie Plame's name until 3 weeks later. Well, Judith Miller went to jail last year for refusing to disclose who she talked to while investigating the story, and the trial has raised questions about whether journalists can and should always protect sources. To address those questions and answer some from you, our listeners, about us, we turn to Mark Jerkowitz, former media critic for The Globe and associate director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, Judith Miller has said that she ultimately, after being jailed, felt freed by Libby to testify. But what is this trial, you know, her testimony, the upcoming testimony of NBC's Tim Russert, what is this telling you about journalism and sources?
The problem with this case and confidential sources is Judith Miller, who went to jail on a solid journalistic principle, she was probably protecting information that was wrong or that didn't really involve anything in the public interest or that might have involved an attempt by the White House to counter Joseph Wilson's column about Iraq. So she was protecting a conversation and a relationship that did not involve the kind of sort of clear, heroic whistleblowing that we understand to be the important byproduct of confidentiality.
In other words, there's questions about whether sources should be protected who might be spinning the reporters,
Spinning the reporter, giving the reporter wrong information. That's the problem in this case. The information that was protected seems to be more about political gamesmanship than about alerting the public to something they really needed to know.
Hmm. Well, Mark Jerkowitz, now I hope you can help us answer some questions that were raised by our listeners after our coverage last week of the Libby trial. After our coverage, we played a portion of an interview exchange between Vice President Dick Cheney and CNN's Wolf Blitzer. I know you've heard it. Now, the testiness of the exchange when it pertained to Iraq had Washington reportedly buzzing about whether Cheney was feeling the strain of the trial and its spotlight on the actions of his office. And we played it in that spirit so listeners could hear for themselves. But the exchange that we played ran into another unrelated exchange between Blitzer and Cheney about Dick Cheney's pregnant daughter, Mary, who is a lesbian and has said she's going to raise the child she's expecting with her longtime partner. Now, some of our listeners have said Wolf Blitzer was out of line asking such a personal question. Some have said we were out of line in airing it. We agree that we didn't air it with enough context. So we want to add that context here. First, let's listen again to the exchange.
We're out of time, but a couple issues I want to raise with you. Your daughter, Mary, she's pregnant. Some critics, though, are suggesting, for example, a statement from someone representing Focus on the Family. Mary Cheney's pregnancy raises the question of what's best for children. Just because it's possible to conceive a child outside of the relationship of a married mother and father doesn't mean it's best for the child. Do you want to respond to that?
No, I don't.
She's obviously a good daughter.
I'm delighted. I'm about to have a sixth grandchild, Wolf. Obviously think the world of both my daughters and all of my grandchildren. And I think frankly, you're out of line with that question.
I think all of us appreciate your daughter. No, we like your daughters. Believe me, I'm very, very sympathetic to Liz and to Mary. I like them both. That was just a question that's come up, and it's a responsible, fair question.
Right? I just fundamentally disagree with your
point. I want to congratulate you on having another grandchild.
So Mark Jerkowitz, media critic, was it inappropriate for Wolf Blitzer to ask the question?
It's not necessarily inappropriate to ask the question. I think in the question that Wolf Blitzer really wanted to ask is, conservative groups that have in the past supported you and the president and many of the policies that you believe in are saying this about your daughter. Are you willing to repudiate them on this particular issue? He didn't ask it that way. And when the vice president said, you're out of line for asking the question, Wolf basically went into this idea of, well, I like your daughter, I'm not trying to insult you, rather than explaining why he thought the question was a valid political question. And because he didn't, I think a lot of people can sit here today and agree with the vice president that it was out of line.
Some of our listeners have said, stick to policy, not personal questions, but others have said that it was appropriate because it was about policy. It was about how the vice president and the president's policies on the rights of gays have perhaps encouraged those in his own party to be now critical of a member of his family.
Well, the culture wars are a big part of the American political scene, and gay rights is perhaps at this point, along with abortion, you know, the fault line on that issue. So it's not necessarily inappropriate. This was not a question that came from nowhere and said, are you ashamed of your daughter? This was a question that had a political context to it.
Well, we were also taken to task last week by some listeners who thought that in our reporting of the anonymous smear of Barack Obama, we were too slow in discrediting it. Now, this was the rumor that was printed by the conservative website Insight, which reported that Hillary Clinton was going to leak an accusation that Barack Obama attended a Muslim religious school as a child. Both senators, we rush now to make sure we say, have denounced the report. It's considered the first smear of the 2008 presidential campaign. We reported it, again, we admit inelegantly, as an indication of the amount of mud that might be flung at both of these candidates, Clinton and Obama. But listener Marcus Patterson, who's a psychologist, says, you know, I know from research that just repeating rumors serves to reinforce preconceptions in the public's mind. So his feeling is, you know, even if you were raising it to bat it down, that doesn't work. What do you think? Do you report on rumors to discredit them or not?
You don't report on rumors until you're able to either prove that the rumor is false or true. At that point, I think it is fair for news organizations to carefully discuss the rumor, how it got started, with the emphasis on the fact that it is false, perhaps defamatory, and with an emphasis on knocking down the rumor. I don't think there has to be a cone of silence over something that's disproved, particularly when you're talking about how the media function, as long as the essence and the point of the report is to clearly say, hey, this was bad journalism, it was a cheap shot, we're telling you how it happened. I think that's fair and one of the obligations of the media.
And finally, while we have you, Mark Jerkowitz, quick note, the president, or at least his spokesperson, Tony Snow, has apologized for President Bush calling his opponents the Democrat Party instead of the Democratic Party in the State of the Union address. Your thoughts?
Well, that's interesting, because the president has repeatedly used the phrase, and of course Republicans over the years have decided they don't want to use the term Democratic, which I guess, you know, sounds too idealistic or too positive. Democrats have chastened at that for years. As a matter of fact, after the elections, the midterm, there was a sense that, well, if the president really wants to reach out to Democrats, one of the first things he can do is just this little semantic tweak in which he can actually start calling them the Democratic Party. I think the interesting thing will be to see whether he actually uses the term in the future.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and thank you, Mark, for helping us try to be a little more excellent.
My pleasure, Robin.
And as always, we love to hear from you. Our email address, letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. Well, later in the show, an original play that tackles the subject of breast cancer. It's up for College Theater's Tony Award. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. As Thomas Wolfe put it, you can't go home again. And he could have added, because who can afford it? The emotional pull of the ancestral home takes on a new dimension in this real estate market gone haywire. A 26-year-old liquor store clerk, Brad Ford, is discovering that. Brad was largely raised by his grandmother in her house on Cape Cod here in Massachusetts. The 3-bedroom, cedar-shingled, Cape-style house overlooking the ocean has been sold 4 times since his family was forced to sell it after she died in 1992. What happened was adult siblings who wanted to keep the house couldn't buy out siblings who didn't want to keep it, and so they had to sell. The sale price then, $385,000. Now, the asking price is close to $1.8 million. Well, Brad can't afford that, so he's turned to you for help. Brad is using his MySpace page online. He's asking you or anyone to donate $1 to help him realize his dream. He's on the line with us. And, Brad, how much have you raised so far?
I personally, talking to my friends and everything, I've raised about $50 to about $100 already for it.
Okay, well, why is the pull so strong for you to move back into this house?
I grew up there. I mean, I was born in 1980, and I spent all my holidays there. And my summer's there. My mother was a floral designer, so I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, not so much with my mother.
You had your swing set there. You could walk to the beach.
I could walk to the beach. Yep. I could ride my bike to the beach. I had all my birthday parties there. All my friends would come over. It was just, it's a comfort. It was a comfort zone for me, and I don't have that anymore, and I want that back.
Well, you know, and I'm sure you hear this from a lot of people on Cape Cod or the islands. You know, anybody who lives in a vacation spot anywhere in the country that also happens to double as a tourist spot, I imagine it's really hard for people who grew up on the Cape in areas that, you know, maybe were right on the water to now live there because, the value has gone up so much.
Right.
How'd you get this idea? Did you have inspiration?
A friend of mine and I were driving by the house one day and saw it was for sale, and we were just like joking around and everything. We're like, hey, I wonder if we started like a website or something, maybe we could get people to donate us money to buy this house back, seeing it as this was my childhood home.
We've heard about this being done before. In fact, we spoke to the fellow who used a red paperclip.
Yes, I've heard about him.
Yeah, he started a series of trades online, and it resulted in him owning a house in Canada.
Right.
That's in Saskatchewan. You know,
yes.
This is Cape Cod. Do you worry that the house is going to sell before you can get the money?
That's in the back of my mind, but in my opinion, anything you put your mind to, it can come to fruition for you. If it gets sold, it's going to go back on the market, and I'm going to try it again. Mm-hmm. And it's that important to me. I want the house back. I mean, yeah. I will do pretty much anything to get that house back.
Brad, do you think once you get the house, I hate to be, throw cold water on this, but do you think even if you were to get the house back, could you afford the taxes on an almost $2 million house now?
With friends and family who are willing to help me with this, I think I could.
Yeah.
I really honestly think I could.
I say this because you may be sparking memories. I remember my parents were left a house at Tupper Lake in upstate New York and couldn't take it because they couldn't afford the taxes.
Right.
You know, some people can't afford to go back to where their childhood memories are. But I understand this isn't all about the past for you, that
no.
It's about your future. Tell us about that.
My mom and dad were married in the backyard of the house, and my girlfriend of 7 years that I've been with, I really would like to get married in the same place that my mother and father did. And I don't want to have, like, a big wedding. I just want to do, like, khakis and a polo t-shirt and have a barbecue with my friends and her friends. That's what I would like. And she actually agreed to the same thing as well. Why spend money on a wedding when we can just do it simple?
Brad Ford, he lives on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and he's trying to buy the home he grew up in by soliciting donations on MySpace. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
By the way, this song was recorded in the garage of the house Brad's trying to buy. It's his uncle's old band, Green Magnet School. For more on his Homeward Bound project, visit our website, here-now.org. He says he wants a simple wedding, but he wants to have it in a $1,700,000 home. $50 to $100 down, collected so far, $1,000,000, about $700,000 to go. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Thank you. Young, It's Here and Now. The Tony Awards of the college theater world will be handed out this April, and this month and next, regional competitions are being held throughout the country to find out who the winners will be. It's a big deal. Every year, eager young actors, playwrights, and directors enter the American College Theater Festival. A select few will have their work produced, all expenses paid, at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Well, there are 5 original plays this year competing with the classics in categories such as acting and directing. One of those original works is Song of Miriam, about a woman with breast cancer. Its writer and director is Gabrielle Orca, a recent graduate of the Boston University School of Theater. And Here and Now's Lynn Menegon caught up with her at a rehearsal of Song of Miriam.
I want you to shave my head.
You have beautiful hair. I'll cry. You want Lynn to cry? You crazy Mimi, what you teach me many weeks ago? What mean crazy and your language?
Meshuggahna.
Mimi is Meshuggahna. Meshuggahna Mimi.
Please.
I'm Gabrielle Orca, playwright and director of Song of Miriam.
They will take away my scissor. It's crime.
Please.
I don't have razor.
Yes, you do.
The essence of Song of Miriam is a struggle and celebration of life. It's a woman's journey with breast cancer, and it's also about her interconnectedness to the women in her life and the cosmos. And through her journey with breast cancer, she's able to find her place in the universe. She's able to go from a place of fragmentation to a place of wholeness.
Ling, touch my head!
So there's Miriam, who's 28. Bill is her lover. There's Ling, who's her Asian hairstylist, who's humorous and puckish, but also very wise. Then there's the 3 fates, and the fates wear neutral masks. A neutral mask is a white mask that seems to change expression based on the physicality of the mask wearer.
Amazon women of heaven, with thick braided hair. One babe on the back, one bow, one arrow, one breast.
Why write a play about breast cancer?
When I wrote this, there were 3 women in my life of varying degrees of closeness who were diagnosed with breast cancer.
It's such a serious topic, and you're so full of life. How do you translate something so sober and maybe even abstract, an idea, onto the stage and make it watchable?
I approach this as 2 different plot questions. We've got the real world, Miriam's real world. We have Miriam and her 3 women who support her. And then we've got Miriam and her spiritual support system, who are the fates. So the major plot question in the real world is, will Miriam survive with both her breasts intact? And in the spiritual world is, will Miriam find wholeness? And I will tell you, through breast cancer, she does find wholeness.
Are you sure there isn't a ring in hand?
Yeah, I'm sure.
You still got a receipt, right?
Would you just open it?
They can't.
It's not a ring. Yeah, I'll open it.
In the rehearsal, you used a technique. You called one character aside and whispered something, a surprise, like you're going to tell Miriam you're breaking up with her. It's one thing you did with Bill, the boyfriend, and it played out in a very dramatic way.
And freeze. Instead of you proposing, tell her that you're seeing somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's really surprise her for this.
All right.
I leave your socks everywhere. Don't you ever pick them up?
I'm seeing somebody else.
What? Did you just say that you're seeing someone else?
Yes, I said I'm seeing somebody else. Do you want me to say it again?
Yeah, say it again.
I'm seeing somebody else.
The actress ended up taking off Bill, the actor's, pants because she was so mad at him. How do you know when to jump in? When do you know what an actor needs? What do you know what a play needs?
I'm still learning. And I often feel like I'm just flying by the seat of my pants. I really do. I wrote in my director's notes, there are some times where I felt like as a director, I was like wrestling with Shiva, the god of creation and destruction, with his 4 arms. and then some. It depends what sculpture you see. And then there were times that I felt that I was kind of being like Michelangelo, where my actors and the script were this wonderfully unchiseled, uncarved block of marble. And all I had to do was witness, be present, and let the play emerge by itself.
It seems very intense.
It's super intense.
Are you sure there isn't a ring in here?
Nice.
Yeah,
this line was totally
sure.
Different from every other time you did it. Did you feel that?
Totally.
Okay, good.
Are other plays in the American College Theater Festival going through this much work?
It's so hard. I mean, I didn't even tell you what these kids, what our schedules are like. You know, classes start 8:30, 9:30 in the morning. They go all the way through, sometimes not even a lunch break, sometimes a half-hour dinner break, and rehearsals go from 7 to 11 at night. And they get home at 11. It's like, when do we have time to do anything but be artists, be storytellers? I'm sure that other schools have their own journeys and their own challenges and their own craziness. But our process has been really wonderful and all-consuming.
I was not expecting him to say that at all.
Isn't it fun?
Yeah. Sometimes you forget acting is supposed to be fun.
Mm-hmm. Have any breast cancer survivors seen this? What have they said?
They were so touched, so moved. One woman came up to me. She says, I've been in remission. I haven't had breast cancer for 10 years. And I thought I was over it, meaning over it like emotionally. She said, this play unpacked things. That's her word, unpacked things for me. I didn't know we're still inside of me. But it was a positive kind of unpacking. It was a therapeutic kind of unpacking. So I think art can heal. And when a play deals with issues that are universal, like illness, like friendship, like faith when everything seems super bleak, like humor when that's the only way that you can get up in the morning, I think that can help people in their journey, in their life, and change can ripple, and healing can ripple outwards and affect things globally as well.
Amazon women of heaven, with thick braided hair, beat your hollow chest for me.
I think I even know how much this is affecting me, like physically and emotionally. I think I've been waking up for having Kennedy Center nightmares, and I just gotta give birth. I'm gonna midwife Miriam like nobody's business.
Here and now's Lynn Menegon speaking with playwright and director Gabrielle Orca. Gabrielle's original play, Song of Miriam, debuts tonight in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, in the American College Theater Festival's Northeast Regional Showcase. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns, Austin Mayfield, Leslie French, and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor, Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.